TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness. Sandor Katz, Wild Fermentation. When Sandor Katz left New York and joined a rural off-the-electric grid community in Tennessee 2 decades ago, he knew very little about growing vegetables and even less about fermenting. His amazing development as teacher and author of 2 books, Wild Fermentation and The Art of Fermentation, was fueled by fond memories of pickles he relished as a kid in New York City, love for the nourishing power of good foods, and his deep interest in the culture, arts, and history of fermentation. His great appeal as a teacher and speaker also lies in his direct and honest approach to life. He is openly gay and living with AIDS and is convinced of the healing power of food. The 2012 Heirloom Seed Expo, an annual event at the height of the harvest season in Santa Rosa, California, brought together the dedicated food activists with their organized resistance to genetically modified foods, and the steadfast farmers who have been protecting our common inheritance in seeds and plants. In my recent TUC radio programs, I have so far focused on those who make the case that much of current industrial food ranges from bad for you to deadly. Today it is my pleasure to present to you Sandor Katz and his eloquent redemption of the much maligned bacteria and microorganisms without which fermentation and even life would not be possible. Sandor Katz.
Broadly speaking, fermentation is the transformative action of microorganisms. Not every transformative action of microorganisms results in something delicious that we want to put into our mouths. And in fact, most of the transformative action of microorganisms results in decomposition, and specifically we reject food because we call it rotten, because we call it spoiled. But there is a certain inevitability to fermentation. And, really this is because bacteria are everywhere. We are evolved from bacteria, plants are evolved from bacteria, fungi are evolved from bacteria, and really bacteria are the building blocks of life. Now, the corollary to this is that no other form of life has ever lived without bacteria. So even though all of us have been thoroughly indoctrinated into the idea that bacteria are bad, bacteria will make us sick, our lives would somehow be better if we could eradicate bacteria, we couldn't possibly live without bacteria. Many of you might have taken notice of the news reports of the release of the Human Microbiome Project. And this was, an analysis of the genetics of the bacteria that we all live with. And, one of the sort of salient points of this report is that our functionality as human organisms comes more from the genetics of the bacteria that we carry with us than from the genes, that reflect our own unique personal DNA. And in fact, the biologists that count the cells in our bodies long ago came to the conclusion that the cells that we each possess that reflect our own unique individual DNA are outnumbered 10 to 1 by bacteria that we are host to. Or actually, maybe perhaps it is they who are host to us. Whichever way we want to conceptualize it, bacteria are absolutely essential for our ability to function in this world. Human beings could not effectively reproduce without the action of bacteria. Human beings could not effectively digest food or assimilate nutrients without bacteria in our bodies. Bacteria synthesize many essential nutrients for us. Bacteria regulate what we call our immune system. Just this year, research was published that found that when we have a lung infection And our body mounts an immune response, you know, white blood cells that come and sort of, you know, surround that infection and eat it up, that it's actually gut bacteria that are the mediators of that immune response. Other recent research has found that the release of serotonin in our brains is regulated by bacteria in our gut. So the bacteria in our gut do a lot beyond digesting food, as if digesting food was not essential enough. So you know, bacteria are just turning out to be essential for every aspect of our physiological function. And then contrast that with the, you know, the worldview that, you know, really like all of us have grown up with, this idea that bacteria are bad. You know, what is the sexiest thing that you could write on a container of soap that you're trying to market in a supermarket? You write that it kills 99.9% of bacteria. You add this chemical compound called triclosan, and you try to seduce consumers with the idea of killing bacteria. Well, it is not beneficial to us to kill 99.9% of bacteria. And, you know, when I ask audiences sometimes, you know, how many people think that fewer people are getting sick because everyone's washing their hands with soaps that kill 99.9% of bacteria, all it does is make people laugh or giggle uncomfortably because, you know, obviously fewer people are not getting sick because everyone is washing their hands with these products. So anyway, you know, I call this the war on bacteria. It's this misguided ideology that the bacteria are bad and that, you know, we should kill them and that our lives would somehow be better if we could succeed in eradicating them. And really, like, nothing could be further from the truth. We desperately need bacteria. And because there are all of these chemical compounds in our lives, the material manifestation of the war on bacteria, you know, antibiotic drugs, chlorine, and you know, understand that antibiotic drugs, I mean, you know, I certainly am among the people in this room who could say that antibiotic drugs have saved my life. However, they are wildly overprescribed, and more so than in the human population. You know, animals in confinement agriculture are pumped up with huge amounts of antibiotics, meaning that it winds up in our milk, it winds up in our meat, and it winds up in our water. So, you know, all of us end up ingesting antibiotics pretty much on a daily basis. You know, combine that with the chlorine that's in municipal water systems, you know, also for a reasonable reason, but this all has an impact on our gut bacteria. You know, we are the battleground of this war against bacteria. So human beings are not the only ones who have bacteria and require bacteria. You know, all of the other forms of life that constitute our food also are filled with bacteria, covered with bacteria. All of the plants that we eat, the animals that we eat, are covered with bacteria. You know, bacteria is the context for all life, and so, you know, bacteria are also the context for our food. This is why our food decomposes, is that it's covered with bacteria. Now, you know, our ancestors, without the benefit of microscopes or, you know, sort of, you know, knowing the Latin names of the different kinds of organisms that were decomposing their food, observed that by manipulating environmental conditions, they could guide the changes to the food. So that, you know, rather than food just decomposing, rather than food turning into something rotten or spoiled, or otherwise inappropriate to eat, you know, people figured out how to manipulate environmental conditions to encourage other kinds of organisms that are also present on the food to develop. And these organisms actually make food more stable, more digestible, more delicious. And these are the foods that have emerged as fermented foods. And people eat these foods all over the world. I would venture to guess that almost everyone in this room has eaten something fermented already today. I mean, if you started your day with a cup of coffee, if you ate a piece of bread, if you had some cheese, if you had some chocolate, if you had some salami, if you had any kind of a condiment that has vinegar in it, everybody's diets are full of fermented foods. According to one scholar of fermentation, one third of all food that human beings put into our mouths has been transformed by fermentation before we eat it. you know, I certainly don't know about every culinary tradition that exists on this world, but I've been looking really hard for 15 years or so for a counterexample, for an example of, you know, some culinary tradition that does not have fermentation, and I cannot find any, and I do not, I just conceptually, I don't believe it could exist, because, you know, all of, if you want to, you know, live a hunter-gatherer lifestyle and spend every day procuring the food that you're going to put into your mouth on that day, then, you know, you maybe could live without fermentation. But, you know, as soon as you get involved in the idea of, you know, keeping food for a day or two or five or a month or months, then inevitably you have to deal with the microorganisms that are present on the food. Now, we don't find single microorganisms on our food. Sometimes when I'm on tour doing sauerkraut making workshops, I'll carry around a piece of cabbage, you know, for like a few weeks, and it'll just get, you know, uglier and uglier, covered with molds. You know, we don't only find lactic acid bacteria on our vegetables. Molds can literally reduce a head of cabbage into a puddle of slime, and the puddle of slime bears no resemblance to, you know, tangy, crunchy, delicious sauerkraut. It's biodiversity. You know, there are a multitude of different kinds of organisms that are present on every bit of food that we eat, and it's the environmental conditions under which they are stored that determines which of these organisms can grow. And so, you know, the technique for making sauerkraut is you get the vegetables submerged under their own juices. You shred the cabbage, you salt it, you squeeze it or pound it a little bit, stuff it into a jar or a crock, and that's how you make sauerkraut. So what you're doing by getting it submerged is you are depriving it from access to oxygen. And so the molds can't grow, and by this environmental manipulation, we encourage the growth of what we want, which is the lactic acid bacteria that make it stable, that prevent decomposition, make the cabbage stable, and preserve the nutrients and enable people in temperate environments to survive through the winter with access to vitamin C and other plant-based nutrients. You know, we could say that, you know, coexistence with microorganisms is a biological imperative, and the fermentation arts are really our human cultural manifestations of this essential biological fact. So now let me talk a little bit about culture. You know, culture is this big word that has a lot of different meanings. You know, at one level, it's language, it's music, it's belief systems, scientific knowledge. You know, we could say it's the totality of all the things that we seek to pass down from generation to generation. And yet we also talk about cultures. You know, you culture cells in a petri dish. We describe the community of organisms that turn milk into yogurt as cultures. So this word exists at all these different levels. And, you know, the origins of the word culture, our English word culture, is a Latin word for cultivation. And so, you know, it's this idea that, you know, sort of cultivation of the soil, and then, you know, our understanding of what kinds of things we could cultivate has grown over time. So, you know, in addition to, you know, agriculture, we have, we have aquaculture. You know, people talk about culturing pearls. People talk about culturing their children. You know, people talk about popular culture. So, you know, our notions of what could be cultivated have changed. But I think it's very interesting that we use the same word to describe these little communities of bacteria that we use to describe this grand totality. And, I would say that as a group, fermented foods are more than an incidental novelty. I mean, they are somehow, you know, at the core of cultural identity, at least in certain parts of the world. And when you listen to people's migration stories, you know, people who have had the possibility of bringing their most precious belongings with them on their migration journeys always brought their food cultures. So, you know, there are many families in the United States that have a yogurt culture, a sourdough culture, or some other kind of a food culture that they brought over, and it was so precious to them that they just couldn't leave it behind. A woman who I know who lives in Fort Bragg, Betty Steckmeyer, has told me a really beautiful story about her husband's uncle, who brought a Finnish milk culture called Vili across the ocean. And Betty was caretaking this man at the end of his life. And one day he called her into the room. She started a company called Gem Cultures, where you can buy different kinds of food cultures. And she propagated and sold these Vili cultures, you know, for 3 decades before arriving at this point. And so she said one day Van called her into his room and sat up in bed and said, "You know how to take care of the culture." And she said, "Yes, Van, I've been propagating this for 30 years. I'm very good at taking care of it. I'm committed to continue to take care of it." And then the next time she went into the room, he had passed away. You know, that was his dying concern. You know, that was the continuity, was this culture that he had brought from the old country, that he had cultivated through his decades of living in the United States, and that, you know, he couldn't be at peace with the idea of leaving this worldly plane without the reassurance of continuity. And then if you look at people's cultural practices, you know, particularly in ritual and spiritual practices, I mean, whether you're looking at surviving indigenous traditions or whether you're looking at some of the, you know, major world religions, you know, it's fermented foods that are at the core of religious iconography in many cases. You know, it's wine. You know, this is a sacrament. It's a sacred substance, and cultures all around the world have recognized this. You know, certainly humans did not invent or even discover the fermentation of sugars into alcohol. I say that only because there's so much documentation of other kinds of animals, gorging themselves on fermenting berries and experiencing different feelings from that. You know, but what's really the uniquely human cultural accomplishment is that we figured out how to make it happen on our own terms rather than having to wait for it to, you know, happen as a natural phenomenon. Now let me just talk a little bit about this idea of community. I mean, I already mentioned that microorganisms exist in communities. There's never a case where you find some food that has a singular microorganism on it. Or, I mean, that's not true. I mean, in our time you do, but these are, you know, completely human inventions. I mean, the way you find all foods as they are, you know, produced, you know, in the field is, you know, with a multitude of different kinds of organisms on them. And all of the traditional ferments involve communities of organisms. One type of ferment that it's definitely a common everyday food. I mean, I'll bet at least half of the people in this room have it in their, in their refrigerators at home. Yogurt. Okay, so how many people here have ever made yogurt? And probably a lot of you have gone to the store and just bought a package of plain yogurt and used that as your starter. And until about 2 or 3 years ago, that's how I always had made yogurt, is to go to the store, you know, buy a little package of, you know, Stonyfield Farm or Dannon or Brown Cow or, you know, really any of the brands, and make some yogurt, and then maybe I'd try making a second generation from my yogurt, then a third generation from that, and the first generation is really great, the second generation is just like a little bit runnier, like by the fourth generation, it's not even yogurt anymore. Has anyone else had an experience anything like this? Okay, so what I finally pieced together, I mean, just conceptually, just didn't make sense to me. You know, if it peters out after a couple of generations, how could it have endured as a food? And what I finally pieced together is that, you know, traditional yogurt cultures are evolved communities of organisms that evolved with defense strategies to protect themselves from other kinds of organisms, and had this sort of like inherent stability as a community. And really, like, looking around at different kinds of ferments around the world, you know, all the ferments that are perpetuated over time are these sort of evolved, stable communities. But the science of microbiology, you know, really wanted desperately to improve upon the traditional ferments, much in the way that the science of botany has sought to improve upon traditional heirloom seeds. And so actually at the Pasteur Institute in Paris, very early in the 20th century, they obtained some samples of Bulgarian yogurt, and looking at the multitude of organisms in the yogurt, they identified two among many as the critical organisms for yogurt. And so, so yogurt is defined by US law, by the Codex Alimentarius, by the presence of two specific bacteria, Lactobacillus bulgaricus and Streptococcus thermophilus, which is the one that never gets spelled out on yogurt containers. And then, you know, often there's a third or a fourth kind of a bacteria added into them, but what's significant is that they are propagated as isolated organisms, which was not possible until the end of the 19th century. And then they are sort of recombined in a laboratory, and you can buy a starter and make yogurt, and that's what all the commercial yogurt or, you know, all the commercial yogurt that I know of in the United States is made of. And that's why you can't keep on making generation after generation of yogurt. It's because in the name of, you know, technological improvement, people have been disempowered. I have no doubt that for mass producers, there are benefits in terms of you know, consistency or some other benefit to using these isolated organisms. But it disempowers the generalist because you have to keep on going and buying a new starter every couple of generations. And it is exactly analogous to the situation with hybrid seeds. You know, heirloom seeds, you know, every year you can save your seeds and replant them and be a breeder over time and develop crops that are, you know, well adapted to local conditions, and the generalist farmer or gardener is empowered and doesn't have to go and buy new seeds every year. But, you know, once farmers got sort of seduced into the idea of, you know, hybrid seeds with, you know, improved yields, you know, they let go of these heirloom seeds that they had cultivated for generations, that were the cultural legacy that they had inherited. And certainly, you know, hybrid seeds can produce improved results, you know, under ideal conditions. And that's the hitch, is, you know, rarely are conditions ideal. So, you know, it sort of led to the need for pesticides because they were more vulnerable to pests, and led to the need for large-scale irrigation because they weren't adapted to weather conditions in different places. You know, and generalist farmers can't save hybrid seeds. You know, you need to have the A line and the B line, and make sure you're, you know, sort of pollinating the right ones with the right ones. So it ends up being something that has to be done by a specialist, you know, at a special facility, and so it breeds all of this dependency. So there's just sort of such clear parallels between the, you know, technological development of the fermentation arts and the technical development of agriculture. And you know, every kind of ferment, there's a story like this. I mean, you know, sourdough bread, natural leavened breads, I mean, are superior in every way, except they're not as fast. So, you know, we live in a culture where time is money. So the idea of where you can just get a packet of pure yeast and make your bread, you know, out of that, rather than working with the community of yeast and lactic acid bacteria, which takes a little bit more nurturing and a little bit more time, but results in bread with more flavor complexity, that can be preserved for much longer, that actually has an improved nutritional profile due to the predigestion of the lactic acid bacteria. Even tempeh, the most technically demanding fermentation process I have ever done is learning how to propagate a single fungal spore, Rhizopus oligosporus, which is what, you know, most of the tempeh made in the United States is made from. And, you know, anytime you're trying to propagate a single organism, it's just extremely demanding because the air around us, our fingers, our kitchens, just everywhere is full of other kinds of organisms. So there's always the possibility of you know, other things getting in there and sort of, you know, corrupting your purity. Last winter, I had the opportunity to go to Indonesia. And when I visited a village where they were producing tempeh in Indonesia, the starter was a leaf with multicolored mold spores on it. It would be impossible for any traditional ferment to be made with pure cultures because that is such a, sort of human invention of the last 150 years. And so, you know, their propagation was completely low tech because they're working with this evolved community of organisms. So, food relates to communities in many ways other than the communities of microorganisms that are found in them. I feel like, you know, this event is a beautiful reflection of how food brings people together. And it's been a real pleasure to, you know, just see the multitude of vegetables in that great vegetable hall and, you know, see all of these wonderful people who are, you know, passionate about growing food, about preparing food, about eating food, in cultures all around the world. You know, food is the biggest thing that draws people together. When families come together, you know, when you see your old friend, when you have a new neighbor, you know, food is, you know, this glue that holds communities together and draws people together. And I think that, you know, reclaiming our food, taking our food back from, you know, distant corporate control, it's not only reclaiming food and, you know, good flavors and good fellowship, but, you know, it's also, you know, reclaiming our health. It is, reclaiming our environment. It is reclaiming our economics. And it's really at the core of, important social movements and social agendas.
That was the by now famous author of Wild Fermentation and the Art of Fermentation, Sandor Katz. He spoke at the second annual Heirloom Seed Expo on September 13, 2012, in Santa Rosa, California. Get to know him better and find out how exactly to make fermented foods by visiting his website, www.wildfermentation.com. Come back when TUC Radio returns for another half hour of questions and answers. You can hear this program again on TUC Radio's website, tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. There you can also find the link to the website of Sandor Katz, wildfermentation.com, and a recipe for sauerkraut. TUC Radio is produced in Northern California off the electric grid with solar power. You can get information on how to order a CD or a film on DVD with Sandor Katz by calling 1-707-463-2654, and I will repeat that number in a moment. TUC Radio is free to all radio stations and on the web and depends on the support of listeners like you. Your donation, CD or DVD order, keep this program on the air. Call anytime at 707-463-2654. For information on how to order, you can get your CD or DVD by mail or credit card by phone or online on TUC Radio's secure website, tucradio.org. On that website, you can also subscribe to weekly free podcasts. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.